Yes, thank you for that introduction. So an interesting question was just brought up in the last presentation about, you know, the effect of turfgrass species on these various, you know, carbon accumulations for these sites. And that's in general, that's the premise of my dissertation. And this is actually one aspect of that study. So carbon dioxide is the most abundant greenhouse gas. Its increasing concentrations are cause for concern, and soil carbon sequestration is one method in particular for curbing those increased concentrations. Turf systems in particular have shown excellent potential for sequestering carbon, and this has to do with their inherent characteristics of being a perennial crop, often having minimal soil disruption, have high residue turnover, and are typically highly maintained. However, this does offer some there are some limitations with our current knowledge, and those have to do with individual turfgrass species effects on this carbon sequestration potential. Additionally, there's even less information on identifying the reasons for those differences in species effects. So, namely, how those different residues are affecting that residue mineralization. So when we are measuring carbon sequestration, what we're doing is typically measuring soil carbon concentrations in some various pools of carbon and various forms of activity. It's the most effective approach for accurately determining carbon sequestration potential, but it can be costly and as well as time-consuming to collect this data. CO2 flux or carbon dioxide flux is a snapshot of activity that can be an indicator for long-term carbon sequestration potential. It's typically it can be measured in a field or in a controlled growing environment, and a higher CO2 flux indicates that there is higher microbial activity taking place. So that is a representative of organic matter or a turf residue mineralization. So CO2 flux is affected by both the total plant production, which is the quantity of residues that are being added to the soil, as well as the plant residue composition. That's the quality of those residues. And that includes, and CO2 flux includes both plant and soil respiration. And this is excellent when trying to identify management practices that are influencing CO2 flux, but it doesn't exactly help us when we are trying to identify reasons for these differences, especially when we have differences in species of CO2 flux, you know, for their flux. You know, this taking into account this plant and soil is a limiting factor in that type of analysis. So what we need is to identify characteristics of turfgrass residues for these various turfgrass species and how they're influencing CO2 flux rates, and ultimately how these flux rates are affecting carbon sequestration potential. So in order to do this, you're going to have to use a controlled environment. You're going to have to use a similar soil type with a consistent microbial populations with known residue quality and quantities. Therefore, the objective of this study I'm going to be presenting today, the primary objective was of this research was to measure the response of 5 turfgrass species residues on soil microbial activity. A secondary objective was to identify turfgrass residue characteristics that might affect the microbial mineralization. For this study, I used 5 turfgrass species: common Bermuda grass, creeping bentgrass, Kentucky bluegrass, tall fescue, and zoysia grass. The turfgrass tissues were sampled on the 18th of July, 2014, and they were harvested in a regular mowing event in which approximately one-third of the leaf and stem tissue was collected, and the tissue was oven-dried, ground in a UD grinder, and subsequently passed through a 1-millimeter sieve. The residues were analyzed for total carbon and total nitrogen in a Flash EA 1112 elemental analyzer. And hemicellulose, cellulose, and lignin content were later estimated for each of the species residues using sequential fiber analysis. The soil that I used for this entire experiment was a Riker Muscatuck silt loam. that was lightly passed through a 2-millimeter sieve and allowed to air dry. So that way, all of this, the soil for this whole study was you know, consistent in aggregate stability as well as soil type conditions. So in order to use a controlled growing environment, we used microcosms in a 473-milliliter wide mouth canning jar, where 25 grams of the air-dried soil was added to each jar and was later brought to 50% water holding capacity and allowed to incubate 7 days prior to the initiation of this experiment. One particular method that has been used for measuring CO2 flux in the past that is not necessarily used more recently today, but is an alkali trapping method. And this method in particular works very well when using microcosms. And the premise for this method is that you use a strong base such as sodium hydroxide or potassium hydroxide as CO2 traps for measuring the CO2 evolution. And the way that this works is that the hydroxyl group in those bases has an affinity for CO2 to store carbonates, or to store the CO2 as carbonates in solution. What next happens is you use titration with known concentrations of a volume, known concentrations and volume of the acid to determine that hydroxide ion in solution, or by difference, the CO2 adsorbed. So what we had done is we used, after 7 days of that incubation of the soil incubating in the microcosms, 0.2 grams of turf residue for each of the species was added to each jar and mixed thoroughly. An uncapped 20-milliliter glass inhalation vial containing 10 milliliters of that alkali trapping solution of NaOH was placed on the soil surface. The jar containing the soil and the residue and the scintillation vial with the trapping solution was then capped and placed in a dark storage at 22 degrees C until the collection date. So this is a picture with the microcosm with that scintillation vial and that trapping solution immediately prior to being capped and placed in storage. So in order to complete the reaction of of that alkali trap, you need to use barium chloride, and it's added, an excess of barium chloride is added to the scintillation vials, and what you end up with is a barium carbonate, and that is this barium carbonate is what you see in these vials, and that is illustrating the amount of CO2 that's been absorbed. The solution was then titrated to a phenolphthalein endpoint using a known amount of hydrochloric acid. So in order to calculate the amount of the CO2 carbon evolved, you first have to take the amount of acid needed to neutralize the CO2 absorbed in a non-residue control or just a soil-only treatment to get a soil basal respiration rates. And from that, you subtract out the amount of acid needed to titrate for your individual treatments. You multiply by the concentration of the acid and then further by the equivalent weight for carbon in CO2, and you eventually get micrograms of CO2 carbon per gram of soil per day. For this experiment, we had 12 sampling dates, 5 of which were sampled every 6 hours in the first 24 hours of the experiment, and then 2 days subsequently, every 2 days after that, up to 14 days after initiation. The alkali traps were changed every 2 days, and at which point the soil was remixed and adjusted to 50% water holding capacity. We used a randomized complete block design, replicated 4 times for the experimental design. We also conducted this experiment across 2 runs in 2014. The data were analyzed using repeated measures in PROC mixed with a Kenward-Rogers adjustment for denominator degrees of freedom, and PROC limix was used for means comparison of treatments at alpha 0.05. So looking at our results, our treatment, which in this case was our turfgrass residue, significantly affected the amount of CO2 evolved. We also observed differences between sampling dates for the amount of CO2 evolved. There was also a significant difference between experimental run, but because there was no significant difference, or the treatment by run interaction was not significant, and the treatment rankings across runs were not different from one another. We pooled those two runs together. Lastly, there was a treatment by date interaction, meaning that not all treatments performed similarly across all dates. So this figure illustrates the total amount of CO2 carbon evolved as a result of each of the turfgrass species across the 14 days of the experiment. On the y-axis, we had the CO2 carbon evolved, and on the x-axis, we had the five turfgrass species. Kentucky bluegrass, tall fescue, and Bermuda grass were among those species, resulting in the highest amount of CO2 evolved, followed by creeping bentgrass and zoysia grass. This figure illustrates what that cumulative total CO2 evolved looks like across that 14-day study. Again, on the y-axis we had the amount of CO2 evolved. On the x-axis we had the individual sampling dates. And I just wanted to point out that one thing that we observed is, after about day two, there really is no change in rate of accumulation of that CO2 evolved. So most of those changes were happening within that first 24 hours of that residue addition. So what we had done is we used PROC-GLM to analyze the slope in accumulation in that first 24 hours for these various turfgrass species and their effect on that CO2 evolved. And again, on the y-axis, we have carbon dioxide evolved. On the x-axis, we have the various turfgrass species. And again, similarly, comparing the total CO2 evolved compared to the first 24 hours, the very similar trends in our results. The Kentucky bluegrass, tall fescue, and Bermuda grass were among those having the highest amount of CO2 evolved, followed by zoysia grass and creeping bentgrass. So because there was a treatment by date interaction, we needed to look at the individual sampling dates to identify which treatments were resulting in changes in CO2 evolution. This figure is set up very similarly with the CO2 evolved on the y-axis and sampling date on the x-axis. There were four sampling dates in which there were statistical differences between treatments, and those existed on 12 hours, 1 day, 2 days, and 4 days. And on the 12 hours, 1 day, and 2 day treatments, the Kentucky bluegrass had the highest amount of CO2 evolved. On the 2 days, tall fescue was also contributing to the most amount of CO2 evolved. And on day four, there was the creeping bentgrass had the highest. Looking at that residue quality characteristics, we were looking at the relationship between the residue quality with the total amount of CO2 evolved, and we had three different significant relationships between those residue characteristics. Hemicellulose, lignin, and total carbon content were each significantly related to that total amount of CO2 evolved. Cellulose, total nitrogen, and carbon to nitrogen ratios, surprisingly, were not. But one thing that was interesting is that each of those significant relationships were negatively associated with higher microbial activity, which is actually just opposite of what we would have anticipated, because each of those is attributed with a positive relationship with microbial activity. But that demonstrates that this 14-day study may not be long enough of a duration to measure for these particular characteristics when trying to find relationships between these characteristics and microbial activity in a 14-day study. But nevertheless, there were significant differences in microbial activity as a result of the turfgrass species in this 14-day study. And it emphasizes the importance of better understanding turfgrass residues, the residue effects on the carbon sequestration potential. And this will hopefully ultimately provide more accurate information for updating models used in predicting carbon sequestration. I'm actually going to conduct another experiment that looks at this, again, microbial activity, but also some other further residue quality analyses, as well as how these influence aggregate stability over time on a much longer time scale. So with that, I'd like to take any questions you might have, and thank you very much for your time. Yes, sir.
Did I understand that correctly? You took clippings, right?
Yes, that is correct. We did collect clippings.
So it would be a lot more work to assess the effect of
Yeah. Yeah, if I understand your question correctly, is that we were just looking at the leaf litter, and there's also some other plant components that are contribute to this, you know, carbon sequestration potential. So yeah, and absolutely, that's and that emphasizes the importance of this research, is that, you know, this is just one particular aspect of this, and there's a, you know, whole, you know, plant wide aspect, you know, not even just even within species, not even across species.
Thank our speaker.
Thank you very much.